welcome to the Great Books Podcast. Today we'll talk about Leviathan by Thomas Hobbes. I'm your host, John J. Miller of National Review, and you're listening to a production of National Review. Our guest is Andrew Latham, a professor of political science at McAllister College in Minnesota. He's podcasted with us previously several times on Lawrence in Arabia and other topics, and he joins us by phone as we record from Hillsdale College's campus radio station, WRFH in Michigan. Andrew, welcome back to the Great Books Podcast.
Always a pleasure to be here.
Why is Leviathan by Thomas Hobbes a great book?
Well, I thought you might ask, so I have a couple of thoughts. Three reasons. First of all, this is the first modern work of political science. Now, I know that sometimes Machiavelli is credited with that, but Machiavelli was, in fact, in some ways very backward-looking, trying to recapture the glories of Rome, and methodologically very old-fashioned, whereas for Hobbes, it's all about the science. Geometry, astronomy, trying to apply those insights to the study of politics. That's new, and so to my mind, Hobbes really is the first modern political scientist. He's also the father of political liberalism, and that sounds weird because, as we'll discuss, he's very much into the all-powerful state, the Leviathan. And yet, underpinning that is, for the first time really in the history of Western political thought, a radical individualism. This is all about the full flourishing of the individual according to their own lights. Radical equality, none of that Machiavellian or Thomistic or Platonic notion of different strata in society, that the grandees versus people or populo. None of that. Everybody in the state of nature, which we'll talk about, everybody's equal. And then finally, he's the father of political liberalism because he posits that the purpose of the state is to secure human liberty. Freedom of each person to flourish according to their own lights. The very final reason, I think, why this is a great book, this is a topic near and dear to my heart as an international relations guy, he lays the foundation for one of the main schools of modern international theory, realism, sometimes referred to as realpolitik. That tradition focuses on the conflict and competition of states under conditions of anarchy, as we'll see, a condition in which there is no Leviathan. It's incredibly influential to this very day, referencing here discussions around Ukraine and Russia. So for those three reasons, and it's a very good read, too, by the way.
We're going to talk about all of that, what this book says, its purported liberalism, how it connects with John Locke, and even Calvin and Hobbes. Andrew, I want to start with the enigma of the title, Leviathan. That's a biblical sea monster. It's an allusion. It's poetic. It doesn't have a title like, you know, Fourth Discourse on Government or whatever. What's going on here with that title?
Well, it's a very clever title. As your listeners may know, Leviathan is a kind of a sea monster, sometimes a crocodile-like monster, sometimes it takes another form. The Old Testament is, I won't say replete with references to Leviathan, but Leviathan pops up in the book of Isaiah and the book of Job and a few other places as well. And typically, both if you read scripture, but also if you read the scriptural exegesis, both in the Jewish and Christian traditions, the Leviathan is really an evil beast. He really is an avatar of anarchy and conflict and chaos and all kinds of other things that are, you would think, quite contrary to what Hobbes is talking about in this book. But Hobbes is very clear. He's talking about a Leviathan of the book of Job. And he's talking about it at a time when Christians were thinking about or reinterpreting Leviathan in the book of Job, not as an avatar of anarchy or revolution and chaos, but in fact as a great beast, answerable only to God, and capable of ruling and, if necessary, crushing inherently rebellious and prideful human beings. And so he becomes Leviathan in these later interpretations, which Hobbes picks up on. Leviathan becomes a neutral or benign, omnipotent power. And Hobbes makes a distinction between Leviathan, the beast, good, and Behemoth, another biblical beast, who does stand in for anarchy and revolution and chaos. And in fact, there's a title of another of Hobbes's books, A History of the English Civil War. So that's really, I think it's poetic. I think it works perfectly once we dig in a little bit more into what Hobbes is arguing. Leviathan is a perfect title.
Thomas Hobbes published Leviathan in 1651, and there's a familiar etching, an illustration by the title page that always comes to mind when I hear about the book. It's such a familiar image. It's of a crowned giant who looms over a landscape. He's clutching a sword and a Christian staff. And on close inspection, his body is made of people. And then there's a quote from the book of Job, Job 41. There is no power on earth to be compared to him, unquote. Isn't that a strange image for your book?
Well, I always use that image when I teach Hobbes in my political theory class. It's very powerful because it gets, in some way, it gets right to the heart of what Hobbes is all about. Here we have an artificial person, which is a term Hobbes uses, made up of all of the members of the political community. And as we'll see in a moment, when human beings come together to create a political community, they pool their sovereignty. They put it all into one big bucket, as it were, to create this artificial body politic. And that's captured in the most obvious sort of representation in that frontispiece. There's a body comprising many, many smaller bodies. Out of the many, one, to quote Americanism. That's not all that's going on there. The one is created by the many and endowed with certain powers, the sword and the bishop's crozier or staff. So this sovereign, this Leviathan, wields both spiritual and temporal power. And then if you look at all the other little symbols, cannons, lightning bolts, which is an old symbol for excommunication, it just reinforces all of this. And then if you look at the face, some debate about this, but it seems to be a composite of Charles II, who was a patron of Hobbes, and Oliver Cromwell, who was not a patron of Hobbes, but was a consequential political actor at the time. And so there's a lot going on here. When Hobbes writes a handwritten version of Leviathan much later and revises both the text and this image, it changes in some important ways, one of which is that in that second representation, all of the individual humans making up the body politic are now more obviously looking upward toward the Leviathan's head. So as Hobbes' thinking is evolving, this image is evolving as well. But it's a beautiful teaching aid. I think it gets to the heart of what Hobbes is all about. And I don't know what he paid that apparently bohemian artist to do that, but whatever he paid him, that wasn't enough.
Let's jump into the text now of Leviathan. The book has four parts. The first part is real important. It's called Of Man. It's an account of human nature. It also talks about the state of nature, and this is critical to everything Hobbes says. It's one of the most famous parts of the book. What is this Hobbesian state of nature?
So the state of nature is simply the pre-political state. And we have to mention up front, this is a thought experiment on the part of Hobbes. And he's really the first to do this, as we'll see in a bit. I think Locke picks up on it. But he's imagining what life, human society would be like before there was government. And he says basically that you have a number of people. We can talk about it in terms of his anthropology, how he thinks about human nature, how he thinks about social nature and the nature of society, and he builds on both of those in a very geometric way. He deduces from those a political model. So the state of nature is simply the pre-political state in which human beings are pursuing their own interests, minimally their survival, but maximally they're pursuing their vision of the good life as they define it. It's not a Thomistic or Aristotelian notion in which we're hardwired for a particular good life. We each get to make up our own idea of what constitutes the good life, which is a very liberal notion. And he emphasizes, too, that that makes us very fearful, because if we are all interacting with our neighbors on this basis, we're going to find ourselves in a situation where our projects of the good life bump into each other. We're going to be competing for the resources we need to live and competing for the space and the resources we need to flourish according to our own lights. And that's going to generate conflict. And it's that that generates fear, because I don't know what my neighbor's up to, so I'm going to be fearful. Now, rationally, the response to that in the state of nature is to maximize my power, to do whatever I need to do to secure myself against my neighbor, all my neighbors, in fact. That, though, gives rise to a very interesting sociology. If everybody's behaving this way, we find ourselves in one of Hobbes' most famous quotes, in a war of all against all. There's nothing but eternal conflict, eternal fear, eternal pursuit of power. It's suboptimal, this state of nature, because no one can flourish. Fear is everywhere. There's no possibility of what he calls a commodious life. No justice, no commerce, no culture. It's a war of all against all. And that, of course, reduces down ultimately to life being solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. Another one of Hobbes's famous aphorisms. That's the state of nature. And all he means by that is the state, the social state of human beings, given their human nature, when there is no government.
This war of all against all and life is solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. You called it suboptimal. It sounds way worse than suboptimal. It sounds horrible. So nobody wants to live in a state of nature. What do people do about that?
Well, they form a political society. If you think, just to sort of flesh out Hobbes's notion of human nature, we're not only inherently fearful and self-interested, but we're also rational, at least instrumentally so. And so a human being, as you say, in this hellscape, is looking around saying, okay, what's the rational thing to do? Well, the rational thing to do is for me to limit my ambitions and get my neighbors to agree to limit their ambitions so that our ambitions, our pursuit of the good life as we understand it, they don't collide. They don't crash into each other. The problem is one of enforcement. So that's the social contract, right? It's that I get together with my neighbors and I say, look, today I will not try to steal your property, try to take your food, try to kill you, all of those good things. And in return, this is the covenant, you will not try to do that to me. And if we can make that work, then, of course, we can have, it's kind of a liberal dream. We can have a world in which we're all doing our own thing, leading our own lives the way we want to, without the interference of anybody else. The problem is, according to Hobbes, that is not possible absent the Leviathan. So what is the Leviathan? The Leviathan is an all-powerful sovereign who is charged with enforcing contract, social contract that we've just signed, making sure that nobody oversteps their bounds, that it's about reducing fear. So the political response then is to create this sovereign, he calls it Leviathan, as an artificial person charged with enforcing the social contract. And here, though, and this is where Locke, half a century later, kind of departs, not quite half a century, for Hobbes, in order to make the Leviathan work, we all have to sacrifice the supreme authority that we've had over ourselves in the state of nature. We have to surrender that to the Leviathan. So the Leviathan now is sovereign in the sense that there's no superior power except God. We'll come back to that, I think. And that the sovereignty that people have exercised over their own lives has been surrendered to the Leviathan, this artificial person. Think back to the frontispiece image. One point I'd like to make just before leaving this, the politics here is the social contract is not between ruled and rulers. The social contract is between the members of society. They come together and agree to themselves that they're going to create this Leviathan for a very specific and very delimited purpose, even though they invest it with unlimited and supreme power.
So we've moved into part two of the Leviathan, which is called Of Commonwealth. And there's a lot to chew on here, but this business about the sovereign having almost dictatorial powers, does Hobbes worry about tyranny?
Well, that's a great question. Not really. And it depends, too, on how one defines tyranny. Technically, for all of Hobbes's intellectual forebears, tyranny was the rule of the one for the benefit of the one. And so Hobbes is not really endorsing that, but in a broader sense, I guess, he is advocating for a kind of tyranny, a single ruler, not checked by any inalienable rights or set of checks and balances, but a Leviathan with absolute power. But, he says, that is not the same as advocating for a totalitarian state. He wants this state to have a very light touch. In fact, he's quite explicit about this. Although the Leviathan has absolute, unchallenged, unchecked, and untrammeled power, the Leviathan in the person of the king or parliament or whomever should allow, as he puts it, with respect to most elements of life, should allow the law to be silent, which is to say that the Leviathan has the right to do whatever it wants, but doesn't necessarily think it's right to do whatever it wants. So we have here the beginnings of a limited state, but without the traditional checks and balances of, say, a Machiavelli, who talked about constructive factionalism, different factions checking each other, or with John Locke, who talks about a very limited state explicitly. It's all built in here, but it's kind of hidden. It's just kind of below the surface. He is not, though, concerned about building in checks and balances to prevent the Leviathan from becoming a tyrant.
Andrew, you mentioned God has to fit in here somewhere. In Thomas Hobbes' scheme of government and a sovereign and Leviathan, where does faith, where does religion, where does that fit into his conception?
Well, first must be said, he wasn't an atheist. And that's a charge that was made by his contemporaries, and some people still read back into that. And it's true that in the earlier version of Leviathan, the 1651 in English version, he's a bit iconoclastic in some ways. He's pushing the margins a little bit. But that's not part of his overall sort of scheme when it comes to politics. He is a Christian. He's not much of a Christian. His Christianity boils down to God is the first mover. And at the end of days, Jesus Christ will return to judge us all. There's not much in between there. He's a mortalist, which was a form of Christianity at the time, which held that he's a materialist. So he believes that once the body dies, the soul dies as well. And the soul will be recreated at the last judgment. It gets complicated and it's not overly germane, but it's important in at least this way. Hobbes did not want any religious authority to interfere with the power, the absolute power of his Leviathan. He didn't want priests or bishops running around saying, obey me, not the Leviathan, because the Leviathan can punish you in this life, but I can punish you in the next. He didn't want that. In fact, what he wanted was a religion in England at the time, Christianity, that was subordinate to the state, a kind of department of government, if you like, and that everybody in the realm would have the Leviathan's religion. And that sounds pretty totalitarian. Well, totalitarian is as good a word as any, but not really, because he was, given his time and place, he was very concerned about religious factionalism and how that could amplify some of the imminent dynamics of the state of nature. People were fighting over religion. He wanted that to go away. So publicly, everybody had to adhere to the same religious belief system, the Church of England. But privately, they could believe, he believed, whatever they wanted. So complete freedom of conscience, coupled with complete conformity in public life to the established church. If you look at the, again, back to the frontispiece, he holds a bishop's staff, the Leviathan. He is not subordinate to the bishop. He's not subordinate to the pope. He's not, except in a very abstract way, he's not even subordinate to God. He is the power on earth, and the church then is subordinated to the Leviathan's power, and religious difference is to be privatized and not allowed into the public sphere because that generates strife and conflict.
Published in 1651, The Leviathan was written during the English Civil War. Remind us very quickly, what was the English Civil War, and to what extent is this book a product of its time?
English Civil War, 1642 to 1651, which is the date this was published, a conflict between the Cavaliers, or the Royalists, or Monarchists, and the Roundheads, who were the Parliamentarians. It was a conflict that came in phases. There were three phases. It involved England, but Scotland and Ireland as well. There's a religious overlay, high church Christian versus low church Christian. It's very, very complicated, but it really boils down to who is going to be governing the three kingdoms, but especially England. Is it going to be Parliament, or is it going to be the king? Hobbes' answer was, for most of his life, most of his early life, very much the king, because a single monarch looks an awful lot like a single Leviathan. It makes perfect sense. There's very little scope for factionalism. If one person is in charge, he's not going to be arguing with himself. This is pre-Freud, so one has to factor that in. So that's the backdrop. But there's no real evidence that most of what Hobbes wrote is directly reflective of that, because most of what he wrote before the English Civil War broke out. He was very much a royalist at the beginning. If you read Leviathan and his earlier works, De Cive and Elements of the Law, they're very royalist, very monarchist in their sort of political orientation and theory. The one way in which the war, and he was out of the country for the war, by the way, he headed off, he fled to France because he knew he was on the wrong side. The one way in which that political context does shape his thinking is in the conclusion, the review and conclusion. He kind of changes his mind. There's a big debate in the literature about this, but he kind of changes his mind and he says, look, the Leviathan does not have to be a single person, a monarch. It doesn't have to be a king. It can be a body of people as well. And that has to be read against the backdrop of they just killed the king, King Charles I. And there was a big debate about amongst the royalists, how can you owe allegiance now to this parliament, soon to be dominated by Oliver Cromwell? How can you owe allegiance to this when the legitimate king has been killed? And so Hobbes offers a way out. He says, he doesn't use this language, but basically he says, look, the Leviathan, the sovereign, it's a kind of an office. And it doesn't really matter who occupies it. Could be the king, could be the parliamentarians. It doesn't really matter. It's the office that matters. And so this was his way. Again, he doesn't use that language, but that was his way of allowing him and people like him to reengage with politics in England, despite the fact that they had supported ardently the king, who had now been decapitated and replaced by Parliament.
When we encounter Thomas Hobbes and when students read him or read excerpts of Leviathan, which is a very long book, they tend to read excerpts of it, it's often in conjunction with John Locke. Now, Thomas Hobbes, born 1588, John Locke, born 1632. Hobbes is a generation or more older than John Locke. They were contemporaries. They lived at the same time. Andrew, to what extent are these guys in conversation with each other? Are they in agreement, disagreement, intention? How would you describe it? And why do we always think of Hobbes and Locke together?
Well, they're always taught together, first of all. I always teach them together. The reason for that is that they are one or both sort of the fathers of liberalism. They are in conversation, or rather Locke, although he never mentions Hobbes by name, he's clearly in conversation with him because he builds on Hobbes' notion of a state of nature. Now, the state of nature for Hobbes is a state of war. It's a war of all against all. Locke doesn't go quite that far. He says, no, people are naturally cooperative. There are a few bad apples. We don't need an absolute state to impose order. We need a limited state to adjudicate disputes and to provide for national defense and a few other things. So Locke, building naturally on Hobbes, comes up with the kind of liberal limited state that is then picked up by the founders of the United States, and then that particular tradition of liberalism takes off. But it's Hobbes that invents the idea of state of nature that then morphs in Locke's hands into something which is to us now in the 21st century still barely maybe, but still recognizable as political liberalism. They're very much connected. I don't know how I would teach Locke without teaching Hobbes first, if only because he's an interesting foil, but really because he gives Locke a lot of the raw materials that Locke then works in a very different way.
Listeners who want to learn about John Locke can check out episode 103 of this podcast series, which is on two treatises of government. So go back and do that if you're interested. The other name that I associate with Hobbes, in addition to John Locke, is Calvin. And by that, I mean the Calvin and Hobbes comic strip by Bill Watterson. Is there a connection between Hobbes in the comics and Hobbes, our political theorist?
There is, and there's a little bit of debate out there about what that connection is, but I'll give you the two stories, one of which is an attempt to be serious that Hobbes, in the Calvin and Hobbes strip, Hobbes is the more urbane, down to earth, cautious, realistic, those sorts of things. And that's meant to kind of be a reflection of the groundedness and the somberness of Thomas Hobbes, the 17th century Thomas Hobbes. Watterson himself actually has a different version of the story. He says in an interview, 1997, I think, that it was a joke. It was kind of hat tip to his faculty from his alma mater, Kenyon College. He was just making a kind of, paying them a bit of an homage, I guess. Yeah, I remember Thomas Hobbes from all those dry lectures all those years ago. And then Calvin, apparently that was just a coincidence. It's not meant to be D. John Calvin. So I don't know which is true, but they're both kind of interesting takes.
Was Leviathan written in English or in Latin? And is it hard to read or easy to read, this 17th century prose?
Well, if you like Shakespeare, it's not too hard. There are three versions. The original one was written in English by Hobbes. That was 1651. Partly reflecting its time, I said earlier, it was a little bit risque when it came to some of the religious questions, because that was permissible to some degree at that time in that England. He writes the Latin version for a continental European audience about a decade and a half later, and that is scrubbed of a lot of his irreverence, if I can put it that way. So the people who claim that Hobbes is a bit of an atheist or something atheist adjacent point to the English version, because you don't find that in the Latin version. And then the third version, which I mentioned earlier, is the so-called scribal version, which is a much shorter version, handwritten by Hobbes himself. All three versions are largely similar, but there are differences. As I said, the irreverence of the original English version is lost in the Latin version. There are a few other minor changes here and there, but basically it's the same overall political vision.
If a listener wants to read Leviathan, what do you recommend? Is there an edition or a translation that we should look up?
Yep. Again, it depends. If you're a scholar and you're writing your own book on Thomas Hobbes, and the only version for that really is the Oxford Clarendon edition by Noel Malcolm. It's three volumes. The first one is Noel Malcolm's take, his the background, the context, his interpretation, etc. It's beautifully done. The other two volumes are the entire book, Leviathan, and on facing pages, one side of the page is English, the other side is the same passage in Latin. So you get to track, as he does in the Marginalia, you get to track the changes and different emphases and whatnot between the English and the Latin versions. You can just read the English if you want. It's a great translation. But if you want to compare it to the Latin, that's available as well. If you're teaching an undergraduate course where accessibility is more important, it's at a premium, the version in the Cambridge History of Political Thought series by Richard Tuck is, I think, without parallel. It strikes just the right balance in terms of context, in terms of accessible language, simplified a little bit here and there. It's my students like that, or passages from that particular edition.
Let's conclude with a final question that builds on that one, which is there a reason to read Leviathan by Thomas Hobbes today, other than the fact that your political science professor may have assigned it to you? Is there a reason to pick up this book and read it now in the 2020s?
Well, it has to be said that if your political science professor insists you read it, you should read it. But yes, because the book not only talks about certain kinds of politics that are necessary for social peace and individual flourishing, it talks about political morality, the kind of morality that each of the citizens has to live by if this system is going to work. And if they don't, I'll give you a few examples in a second, but if we don't live by this political morality, the Leviathan will collapse. We will revert to a state of nature, which, as you characterized earlier on, would be hellish. And I think when I read this list, some of this will resonate. He says this political morality should entail: people avoid making signs of hatred or contempt towards others, pride, arrogance, avoided. Equality and impartiality of judgment must be maintained. Individuals should not get into big conflicts over minor issues. We must pardon those who've committed past offenses. So he goes on and on. There are 17 or 18 of these points he makes that are essential elements of the political morality that flow from the social contract, that reinforce the reign of Leviathan, and that create the conditions of possibility for social peace and human flourishing. And I think every generation needs to be reminded of exactly that.
Andrew Latham, thanks so much for joining us and telling us all about Leviathan by Thomas Hobbes.
Always a pleasure.
You've just listened to The Great Books Podcast, a production of National Review. Please subscribe to The Great Books Podcast and leave reviews of the show. That helps us keep this podcast going. Send me your ideas for future episodes. You can reach me through my website at heymiller.com on Twitter. My handle is at heymiller. And last of all, special thanks to all of you for listening. We'll be back next week with a new episode of The Great Books Podcast.